Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, as we continue to pour through the big old monster box of baseball cards. And we are wrapping up with 1989. Yes, you know, the market was way flooded with production. When it takes 3 weeks and six podcasts to get through 1 year of baseball cards. Oh, wait. There will be more. Yes, 1990 is just around the corner. But let's wrap up 1989 with a look at 89 Tops. Our random draw, a very interesting and timely person here. Card number 560. No, not Tim Raines. Rock Raines. Yes, we will be rocking with Tim Raines, talking about his career, a Hall of Fame-worthy, perhaps, career. But some caveats I want to throw out at you, and in particular the writers who do make those Hall of Fame selections, those Hall of Fame votes. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. But first, let's get to your comments at Wax and Gum Stains. That is our Twitter feed. Make sure you tell a friend about our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and kindly remind them that the Wax Ecstatic podcast comes out every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom. Also, through iTunes. Going back a couple of podcasts to the 89 Donruss podcast, where we had Kevin Brown as our random pull, MJR Sports Cards asking the question, was Kevin Brown traded for the same Brandon Whedon that quarterbacked the Cleveland Browns? The answer to that question, yes, that is the same Brandon Whedon, who was traded along with Jeff Weaver and Yancey Brazelbon to the Dodgers for Kevin Brown. That was back in 2003, or following the 2003 season, I should say. Of course, Brandon Whedon never made it to Major League Baseball. Bounced around a little bit with the Kansas City Royals. He was a Rule 5 draft selection. Didn't get any higher than, I believe, Class A in the California League. But certainly was able to string together a little better of a professional football career. Although anyone that's connected with the Cleveland Browns, it's highly debatable if that's better than anything else. But yes, to answer your question, MJR Sports Card, yes, that is the same Brandon Whedon involved in the Kevin Brown trade. Moving on to our friend Waxpack916, talking about this podcast, actually. Can't wait for 89 Tops. This set is very nostalgic for me. It was my first set collected. I love the design. And he goes on sending us a picture of the Kelly Downs card. And he says, some of the 89 Tops cards are etched in my memory from my childhood, like Kelly Downs with green fence in the background. That is the old bullpen in Dodger Stadium. And I know that because the 1990 Topps card for John Wetland has the exact same background. He was warming up for a relief appearance. And that was a pretty good advertisement for vinyl siding, I believe. As the Dodger Stadium bullpen, of course, in the late 80s and early 90s, still with a lot of the same accoutrement of the original 1962 design. So be it Kelly Downs in 1989 or John Wetland in 1990, we get to see the quality corrugated plastic background of the Dodger Stadium bullpen in both of those cards. Let's see, Joey W. chiming in. I bought so much 89 Tops. Now you can pick up a box for single digits. The beginning of the end. Well, it sounds like the beginning of the end of maybe your interest in collecting those cards. But yeah, it's a set that, and we'll get into this in just a little bit, it's a set that's very popular because of its design and because of some of the star power. But it is one that was massively produced, and you can get them for a pretty good deal nowadays. And we'll get into the merits of why you should invest in 89 Tops in just a little bit. Peter Steinberg, dude, I love your baseball card podcast. Admittedly, your Harry Carey is better than mine. It needs work. Cheers.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate the warm comments about my comments about Jaime Moyer at our last podcast on 89 Fleer. You know, Peter, if you spell Steinberg backwards, you get Grubnitzed.
That's the best I can do. That is Harry Carey on demand. So I hope you enjoyed it there. I hope you enjoyed the commentary on Wax and Gum Stains. Again, you can comment at any time via our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Talk about our podcast. Talk about the Harry Carey impressions. I don't do too many requests, though, so please Don't have me leave a message on your voicemail claiming to be Harry Carey. We're not going to do that. Also, you could talk about the hobby. You could talk about the sport. You could talk about whatever is on your mind at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, let's get right into the 89 top set. And again, our random selection card number 560, Rock Reigns, not Tim Reigns. Now, they actually went by his nickname, Rock Reigns. And this is the unusual nickname. You know, we discussed a little earlier, I'm trying to remember which podcast it was. It was a while back. It was a good month or so ago. Somebody was asking me who had the better nickname. Was it Jim Catfish Hunter or Dennis Oil Cam Boyd? And we discussed how it was actually awkward seeing cards use their legal name. When you saw a card just refer to Hunter as Jim Hunter or Boyd just as Dennis Boyd and not Catfish or Oil Can, respectively. So this is kind of the reverse nickname here. You know Tim Raines mostly as Tim Raines, but not by his nickname Rock. He did not get that nickname because of his cocaine habit. That's another story we'll get to. But it was actually because he was so physically fit, so chiseled for a guy his age, and also for his size, too. You know, he was, I wouldn't say undersized, but he was certainly not a guy who was 6'3", 6'4", something that stood out along those lines. 5'8", 160 pounds officially, but very, very well built. And to the best of our knowledge, not with the assistance of any kind of steroids or anything along those lines. But we'll get to Tim Raines or Rock Raines' career in just a little bit. But let's take a look at the 89 top set. It is one of my favorites, and much like Wax Pack 916, sentimental reasons for me, as this was the first set that I was introduced to. I've told the story before, so I'll just give you the short version here. When I was 12 years old in 1989, in the summer of 1989, went to a local grocery store with my mother, since it was the middle of the 89 baseball season. The grocery store was clearing out all these baseball cards. They had literally a bushel basket full of 89 Topps wax packs. And I think there were three for a dollar. My mom said, "Do you want to buy some baseball cards?" I said, "Sure." And, you know, I had liked sports. I had really started getting into baseball right around this time, professional baseball, not just, you know, understanding the rules or watching the game on TV, but really getting the nuances of the game, getting the history of the game, the statistics, and all that other stuff. So it was perfect timing, and I fell in love with the 89 top set and still love it to this day. Now, I've mentioned before that when I got into my late teens and early 20s and I just wanted to disavow myself from the hobby in almost every way possible, I went through my collection, which when I was a kid was up to 50,000 cards, and basically anything that wasn't a star card, anything that wasn't an older card, they got sold to a local shop, and I basically, you know, sold about 25,000 cards for $25, which gave me enough money to get some, you know, plastic sheets and binders for the cards that I was keeping, a few cardboard boxes, and that was about it. Well, one of those sets that, or it wasn't a set, you know, one of those lots that I moved out that I actually regret getting rid of was 89 Topps. Now, I still have a pretty decent collection of 89 Topps, a few hundred. I'm trying to think of how I collected them over the years. It must have just been through random wax pack lots that I had bought on eBay. And, you know, you always get that gem, you know, hey, we'll throw in an 82 Topps pack or an 85 Topps pack, but you get, you know, 9 packs of 88 Topps, you get 8 packs of 88 Donruss, and they throw in a few 89 Topps as well. So I think that's how I stocked up on a lot of those cards. But anyways, I'm glad that I still have this stack of 89 Topps, even if they aren't star cards. They are mostly commons or semi-stars because, like I said, I really wish I had that stack of cards back. And I'm really thinking, of course, I still have an 87, a 90, and a 91 Topps collection that is close to being complete sets for all three of those years. I'm actually thinking of adding 89 Topps to that list, probably getting a box of wax packs, ripping through them, and trying to put together an entire set. Because, first of all, it's affordable, as I mentioned before. There are a lot of these cards still out there, but they're at very decent prices. So that may be something that I do, just buy a pack or buy a box of packs, I should say, for 10 or 12 bucks and rip through them and try to put together a set here, because the more that I look at this card, the more I love it. And again, it's a sentimental reason. It was the first set that I collected. I remember some of those first cards. I still have many of them, especially the star cards or some of the rookie cards. But really loved the design. And now that more than 25 years, you know, 27 to be exact, have elapsed since I was introduced to that set and the card collecting hobby, the industry. And, you know, now we look back at these cards and the players that are on them. I really, really love this set. This is one of my favorite sets from the 80s. Of course, 87 Tops is big for me. I love 83 Tops. I've always been a fan of 81 Tops. But 89 Tops, it's right up there. It's got a great design, great star power, great rookie cards or second-year cards, as the case may be. Although the better rookie cards, you have to get through the Topps Traded set. That, of course, Ken Griffey Jr., they kind of missed the boat on that one, which is odd. You know, they included it in the Bowman set, but for whatever reason wasn't included in the base Topps set. Maybe it was to help move some more update sets. I don't know. But the 89 Topps set, a very popular set for collectors, even though it is not full of value because there was so much overproduction, a lot of collectors like me like the design, like the collection of stars and rookies in it, and really just like the whole package together. It just looks and feels classic. And one reason why is the design on the front. First of all, let's take a look at the Tim Raines card here, or Rock Raines again as I look at it. Here you go, Tim, in the on-deck circle, on the road, wearing the classic light blue Expos unis and layers of eye black too. So he clearly was not going to miss a pop-up in the outfield that particular day. Now, even though there is a very big white border on this card, I think there's something unique about the shape of it. It's almost like the shape of an Uno card or the design of an Uno card. So next time you're playing Uno, look at it, where you have kind of rounded corners in the upper left-hand and lower right-hand corner. That's what you've got going on here with the Topps card. So perhaps a little bit of an inspiration from that family-friendly card game. You also have down at the bottom in almost like a Dodgers uniform script, where you have the name of the team and then it kind of tails off and under from the last letter. You've got that with every team, and it just has that real classic baseball feel. Of course, the Dodgers script has been able to kind of express that since it came around in the late 1930s. And I think if you look at any kind of, you know, a sports restaurant that, you know, kind of plays off that Dodger style script, or even Late Night with David Letterman. I mean, if you saw the T-shirts and the sweatshirts that he used to sell, and this back when he was with NBC, he used to sell with that logo where it said Late Night, and then you had the tail under it and said with David Letterman. Very similar look here. Very classic feel. A lot of people like it. And, of course, the team name in this script is in team color, so that's an added touch. And then you've got the player name in the tail there. So like I said, much like Late Night with David Letterman, here you have Expos with Rock Raines. And the beauty of this card too is that even though there's a big border, even though there's a rather large team name and player name in the somewhat garish Dodger-esque script at the bottom, it's a very clean card. The Topps logo, while it's plainly visible in the upper left-hand corner of this particular card, it doesn't dominate the front of the card like you saw Topps do several times ever since the competition came around between Fleer and Donruss in 1981. So even though there are some elements that are, you know, not like today's cards where it's 100% team picture or, you know, a very small line for the player's name, you had a lot of space for the photograph here, and it actually works out really, really, really nice. Now, you have a lot of posed photos like Rock Raines here, or, you know, like the Kelly Downs card that we were talking about earlier in the podcast, but you also have some action shots. The team checklist cards are actually pretty cool. I'm not going to give any love to the manager cards. You know how I feel about those. I was never a big fan of those. But you had some pretty good photography in these cards, and it kind of got Topps back to where they were a little earlier in the decade. We mentioned how 88 Topps was a kind of set because it couldn't match up to what 87 Topps was. Now, 89 Topps, certainly in my opinion, doesn't match up to 87 Topps, but this is a really good product by the Topps company. Let's flip the card over on the back. Something that I remember from these 89 Topps cards is the color combination, a black border on the back. Very unusual for Topps to have a black border on the back, and it provided a really neat contrast when you had the black border on the back and the white border on the front. Also, the black text with the kind of two shades of pink here. You had a light pink for most of the body of the back of the card, and then you had a darker pink for the player's personal information. And then if there was room at the bottom of the card for some kind of trivia fact or some kind of tidbit about the player's career, that's where you would find it. And here you have card number 560, big card number up in the upper left-hand corner. Top's logo over on the right, the player's name at the top. Very neat treatment here of the player's name, where you have the first letter of the player's first name in rather large block format, and then the rest of the name raised up a little bit, and a bar going from the bottom of the first letter all the way across to the other side to the player's position. Not all that different from how SCORE would treat the player's name on the front of their cards in 1991. So kind of a little neat artistic deal here. You've got the complete stats of the player. And what's interesting is there's a little explanation on Rain's card about his nickname. He prefers to be known by his nickname Rock. His brother Ned played in the Giants chain in 1979 and 1980. Ned Raines. Boy, it's unfortunate we never got to see Ned and Rock and playing in the major leagues together. But a very nice, simple design, and again, very memorable, not only because it had some unique artistic tweaks to it, but also, again, the color combination, the two shades of pink and that black border, which again provided some pretty neat contrast to the front of the card. And very different from anything that you had seen from Topps in years before. I think probably the closest to this would have been the 84 set, where you had the dark blue border. But this one just looks a lot cleaner and a lot sharper than the 84 set. And I love the 84 set, but this one just has a really cool feel to it. So when you put the front and the back of these cards together, you get a very classic card here that looks good, has great photography, that classic, like I said, the Dodger script at the bottom of the front of the card, the unique color combinations and design of the back of the card. And this has become a very popular card for collectors. And like I said, very easy to find. There's plenty of it out there. You can get wax boxes, not including shipping, for anywhere $10 to $12. You can get cello boxes for roughly the same price. You can also get complete sets, factory sealed sets. You can still get them for $20 to $30. If you're not into the wax packs but just want a bunch of cards, I've seen the vending boxes, the 500 count vending boxes. You can get those relatively cheap, again, not including shipping, anywhere from $8 to $12, depending on where you're buying them from. So there's plenty of product out there, and even though that depresses the value of a lot of these cards, and again, there are some pretty good star cards and young star players that came up in the 89 top set, even though that depresses the value, it's still a collector's favorite. And not only for sentimental reasons is it one of my favorites, but also simply because this is just an outstanding product. I think in the 1989 sets, this is probably the number two card set, in my opinion, in terms of design and affordability and availability and star power. Of course, Upper Deck sets the bar in 1989. Topps is right behind it. And then you can argue, who's right behind it. Is it Fleer? Is it Donruss? I'm sure we're all in agreement that Bowman and Score are at the bottom there. But I would have to say that very few people would differ with me on the idea that Topps was the second best card that came out in 1989. And if you couldn't afford Upper Deck, then perhaps you really like the 89 Topps set enough to where it's your number one set. And I can't argue with you on that. I think it's an outstanding set. And certainly one where, much like some of the other sets I've brought up from 1989, especially Donruss and Fleer, if you have a few extra bucks and you want to build your set, this is a great one to do it with. You're probably not going to spend more than $30 or $40 building this set on your own. And that's, again, if you want to go through the effort of building it, you can get those complete sets for a few dollars less. But if you're spending more than $40 to build your own 89 top set, you're probably doing it wrong. It's very easy to find these cards, and it won't set you back by a lot of money. All right, let's talk about Rock Raines, or as some people know him, Tim Raines. This is rather timely because it is Baseball Hall of Fame election time and the Baseball Writers Association casting their ballots. And there's a lot of love for Tim Raines. And I can understand why. I think that he presents a very good case to getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. I don't know if he makes it, and I'll get into that in just a little bit. But there are a couple of things that make me scratch my head, go, wait, why are we all of a sudden behind Tim Raines here? So I'll talk about that in a moment, but let's look back at his career. A phenomenal career, an outstanding player. Like I said, he puts up a very good case to be inducted in the Hall of Fame. Drafted in the fifth round of the 1977 amateur draft by the Montreal Expos, and he was part of that young group of kids who became stars and really propelled the Expos into an outstanding stretch of play from the late 70s into the early 80s. But he was able to get the learning curve from draftee to Major League Baseball player rather quickly. He made his debut on September 11th, 1979. Didn't really stick around until the 81 season. That is, of course, the strike-shortened 81 season. But even though it was strike-shortened and he played in only 88 games, he was an all-star. He had 71 stolen bases in 88 games, a .304 batting average, and he was the runner-up to the National League Rookie of the Year, which Fernando Valenzuela just ran away with. That's probably the only person who was able to outrun Tim Raines with anything. And considering how hefty Fernando was, it's pretty unique. But that started a great run with the Montreal Expos. Seven consecutive All-Star seasons for Raines, 81 through 87. Not only was he a Rookie of the Year candidate in 81, but he was often in the discussion for MVP awards. In fact, he was top 10 in the MVP voting in 1983, 86, and 87. His 1986 season was one for the books, a .334 batting average. He led the National League in that department, 35 doubles, 10 triples, 9 home runs, and 70 stolen bases. He was caught stealing only 9 times. In fact, to start his career, he stole 27 bases before he was caught stealing. So this was a guy who was a terror on the base paths. And he was very speedy. He served the outfield very well for the Expos. And he was a guy who would, as we would say in baseball, set the table. You get him on base. He was typically a leadoff hitter. You get him on base, and then you let the power guys either try to knock him around or knock him in with a home run. And he was a guy where if he got on base, and he was very good getting on base, had a career on base percentage of .385. And again, his best years coming in Montreal in the mid-80s, then if you were able to get him on base, you had a good chance of getting at least one run, if not more, depending on what the batters did behind him on the board early. So he was able to prove his worth with Montreal with just his speed alone. And he was also a very good outfielder as well. In fact, his career fielding percentage, and this is accounting for left, center, and right, so all outfield positions in his 22-year career, are .988. Even though he didn't win a gold glove, of course, there were some pretty good candidates that would win that trophy, but he was certainly gold glove worthy throughout his career. Now, some interesting notes from the late 1980s. First of all, even though he was very valuable to the Montreal Expos, he did not get a very valuable contract after the 1986 season. He was a free agent, but nobody offered him a deal. So he signed late in the 1987 season. In fact, May 1st, 1987, he would sign a rather team-friendly deal, shall we call it, $5 million over 3 years with a $900,000 signing bonus. This, of course, one of the best examples of collusion in Major League Baseball. And in fact, he would make up some money on the back end after Major League Baseball owners were found guilty of colluding to keep player costs down. He made up some money from that decision in the early 1990s, $865,000 to be exact. Now, also Raines got into some trouble for drug use. He was a cocaine abuser, and he admits that he not only did cocaine before games or after games, sometimes he did it during games. And he would even keep his cocaine, I can't believe this still, all these years later, he would keep his cocaine in his hip pocket, which was one reason why he would slide head first, because if you slid on your butt into second base, you could have your baggie of cocaine open up and there's just coke flying everywhere amongst the dust in the infield. So he got into trouble with that. And he was part of the Pittsburgh drug trials in September 1985. He would testify against other players. So this is something that certainly held him back in 82, 83, 84. And I'll get to that in a little bit with how it might affect his Hall of Fame status. But fortunately, he was able to get over that. And for all intents and purposes, we believe that he was able to play clean throughout the rest of his life. Now, his time in Montreal would end after that bridge deal, as we call it nowadays, in 1990, as he was traded by the Expos, along with a player to be named later, and Jeff Carter, no, not the hockey player, to the Chicago White Sox, for Barry Jones and the late Yvon Calderon, the Expos sending that player to be named later, Mario Brito, who never got out of the minor leagues. So Raines would move on to the Chicago White Sox, had a very productive few seasons there. In fact, a little over 4.5 seasons appearing in the White Sox playoff run in 1993 as they won the American League West that year. They would lose out to the Toronto Blue Jays in the ALCS. Granted free agency after the 93 season, but surprisingly couldn't find a home. So he re-signs with Chicago. And then at the end of the 95 season, he's on the move once again in a trade, heading to the Yankees for a player to be named later. That player to be named later, Blaze Kozanowski. Suffice to say, he did not make it out of the minors. That is a name player right there. What a name to be sent out later in a deal. So he wins a World Series with the Yankees in 1996, continues to play with them in 1998. Signs as a free agent with Oakland heading into the 1999 season, finishes up a year there, returns to the Yankees very briefly in spring training 2000, can't make the team out of camp, and eventually catches on with the Montreal Expos one more time. He would bounce around a little bit near the end of his career, playing a handful of games for the Baltimore Orioles and the Florida Marlins in 2002, his pro career ending September 29th, 2002, at the age of 43. 22 seasons in the major leagues, or actually 23 seasons, I should say, in the major leagues, 2,502 games, a career batting average of .294, 170 home runs, 430 doubles, 113 triples, 2,605 base hits, and most importantly, 808 stolen bases caught only 146 times. This was a guy who was going to be successful on average one every 7.5 times, just to kind of split it down the middle there in his career. Phenomenal career, and one that is, again, worthy of Hall of Fame candidacy. Now let's take a look at that, because there is much debate. Does he get into the Hall of Fame in his 10th year of trying? Now, baseballreference.com has an outstanding feature called similarity scores, and I like looking at it, especially when you're looking at Hall of Fame worthy players. Now, they break it down into two different categories. You have similar batters and then most similar by ages. So let's take a look at most similar by ages first. Early in his career, he matched up with Max Carey, a player who played in the early part of the 20th century. As he got a little older, he matched up with Ricky Henderson. Carey and Henderson are Hall of Famers. Now, throughout his late 20s and into his early 30s, Ben Chapman and Johnny Damon, two players who were good but not great enough to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Of course, the case, the jury's still out for Johnny Damon, but personally, I don't know if that's going to happen. Now, as he matured later on in his career, in fact, throughout his 30s, he matched up statistically with Lou Brock, Hall of Famer. And by the end of his career, he matched up with Fred Clark, another player from the early portion of the 20th century. So when you look at it, year by year, with the exception of his late 20s, if you're comparing him to other players, he compares with Hall of Fame players. Now, if you look at the similar batters column, you have Lou Brock, Max Carey, Fred Clark, and Eno Slaughter. Those are the Hall of Famers that he matches up with. But you also have several players that are very good players, but you have to kind of hold back on the enthusiasm for Hall of Fame status. And that includes Kenny Lofton, Johnny Damon, Willie Davis, Jose Cruz, Julio Franco. Again, players who had lengthy, quality careers, very good careers, world champions in some cases, but players who are not slam dunks to get into the Hall of Fame, maybe in terms of a veteran vote, but certainly not off of the writer's vote. And as much as I think Tim Raines makes a very good case to be in the Hall of Fame discussion, I think he kind of falls into that little gap between absolute no-brainers and not good enough. He had a good career. It's certainly worthy of discussion, but not a slam dunk. He's going to need the stars and planets to align. Now, one thing that has helped out Tim Raines in his Hall of Fame career is if you look at the vote ever since he was eligible in 2008, the numbers have trended upwards. 2008, he had 24.3% of the vote. Last year, 69.8%. So he was close, but not close enough. So that bodes very well for Raines if he's going to get into the Hall of Fame on this year's ballot. Now, something that works against him is you have to look at the competition. You look at the 2017 ballot, I would have to think Jeff Bagwell, who had just over 71% of the vote, he has the best chance to get in, a very good chance, even though there are some concerns. Was he a PED abuser during his time? That may have been what kept him out, getting so close but not close enough last year. Then you also have to look at some guys who are new to the ballot. Yvonne Rodriguez will be new to the ballot this year. Again, there are some questions. Well, are those muscles natural? But I think if you look at Pudge's career, certainly Hall of Fame worthy. In fact, he kind of falls in the same bucket as Tim Raines. Hall of Fame worthy. Had some pretty dominant seasons. But is it a slam dunk? I don't know. Also, you have to look at some dark horses like Jorge Posada. This will be his first season on the ballot. Now, in my opinion, is Jorge Posada a Hall of Famer? No, not really. But played for the Yankees, won a lot of World Series with the Yankees. There is an East Coast bias in baseball. Hate to say it. That may be one of those guys. Doubtful he gets in on the first ballot, but I think he's certainly in the mix over the next few years. And then you have some guys who have been on the ballot for quite a while who really, frankly, deserve to get in there. Fred McGriff is one of them. Now, I am biased, not only because I was a Blue Jays fan as a kid, but I worked with Fred as a radio co-host for 2 years, many moons ago. So obviously, I'm going to go to the well for him. Unfortunately, though, realistically, I think Freddie falls in that same bucket with Raines. Very good career. But was it a slam dunk? No. And the fact that Freddie was kind of a quiet guy, wasn't all chummy with reporters, that's not going to help out his cause. Also, the fact that he played outside of big markets, that, of course, being Toronto, San Diego, even though the Atlanta Braves were a winner while he was there, it's not New York. Wrapping up his career with Tampa Bay, brief stint with Chicago, brief time with the Dodgers when they weren't exactly at their best, that's going to hurt him. But, maybe somebody has a soft heart for Fred McGriff and he finds his way in. Also an interesting candidate, first time on the ballot, Manny Ramirez. The guy was guilty of using steroids. But, again, here we go, East Coast bias, all those years in Boston, that's going to help him out. And he did have some successful time with the Dodgers. So, all of these factors go into, can Tim Raines make it to the Hall of Fame this year? Again, is he worthy? Yes. Is it obvious? I'm not so sure. Now, one other thing I want to throw out there is we're looking at a few of these candidates and going, well, they may have used steroids, so that may keep them out. I personally don't believe this should hold Raines back, but I want to throw the argument out there. As I mentioned, he was a cocaine abuser back in the early 80s. Now, that doesn't necessarily equate to steroid use, but I know there are some athletes who, if they are not high on drugs, three sheets to the wind on alcohol, properly juiced up, whatever, they don't perform at the same level as if they're clean and sober. The same can be said for rock stars. The same can be said for certain entertainers, especially stand-up comedians. There are some people who, for whatever reason, they abuse something, and they don't feel like their normal self when they're clean and sober. So there is a performance-enhancing aspect to this, maybe not physically. I can't say you'd hit a ball better if you're on cocaine. But mentally, people are doing bumps before games because they're feeling like that's going to put them in the right frame of mind to go out there and be the best athlete that they can be. And while I'm losing a little bit of edge here, but I need something to keep me going and keep the big contracts coming. So they kind of fall into that rabbit hole of abusing drugs or, like I said, alcohol or other substances that maybe doesn't necessarily physically help them, but mentally it gets them in the right frame of mind. Now, again, personally, I don't think that should hold Tim Raines out of the Hall of Fame. I'm a big fan of Lawrence Taylor. Lawrence Taylor had a few issues off the field, shall we say. But he is certainly worthy. What he did on the field is worthy of the Hall of Fame honor that he received a few years ago in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But I bring this up because we have some baseball writers who are holier than thou. And they're going to keep Barry Bonds out of the Hall of Fame. They're going to keep Mark McGwire out of the Hall of Fame. They're going to keep Roger Clemens out of the Hall of Fame. They're going to keep Rafael Palmeiro out of the Hall of Fame. Like I said, they're likely going to keep Manny Ramirez out of the Hall of Fame. David Ortiz, maybe. There's other players who have been suspected and linked to steroid use, and should that put them in the Hall of Fame? Alex Rodriguez is going to go through that exact same thing in a few years. So if you're going to exclude somebody who may or may not have used steroids because you think that was physically performance enhancing, are you the same people who are blowing the trumpet for Tim Raines, even though he used a substance back in the early 80s that other players used, but he used a substance that may have helped him play his game at a high rate, a higher rate than if he was clean and sober? So again, personally, I don't think that should hold Tim Raines back, but I'm challenging the writers out there. If you're a big fan of locking players out because they may have used steroids, are you also giving Tim Raines a big hug because, oh, he was such a great player and a member of the Expos and, oh, never mind about that drug stuff in the past? If that's the case, you're hypocritical. Because if you're going to sit here and claim that everybody who goes into the Baseball Hall of Fame should be acolytes, then you should exclude Tim Raines just as much as you exclude Jose Canseco or Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds or any of those other players. Likewise, you'd also have to clean out half of the Hall of Fame because there's quite a few drug abusers, alcohol abusers, women abusers, womanizers, bad, you know, examples to kids in the Hall of Fame. So again, I don't think it should keep Tim Raines out there, but I like to throw that out there because we've got some people that go, Barry Bonds should never be in the Hall of Fame. He destroyed the sanctity of baseball by sticking a needle in his ass and pumping up and being enhanced by these drugs. Meanwhile, if you know anybody who has abused any kind of drug or alcohol, you know that they're a completely different person when they're on something than when they're sober. And I can tell you, if an athlete feels that he is better off drunk, high, on the cycle, whatever, that is performance enhancing. It's not a physical enhancement, it's a mental enhancement. And if he's going out there with more confidence because he's got a bunch of cocaine running through his veins, that is performance enhancing. Now, also, I think something that is kind of surging Tim Raines forward in the Hall of Fame talk is he's a member of the Montreal Expos. The Expos have not been around since 2004. This is very similar in the hockey world to the Hartford Whalers. Small market team, never able really to compete, had a couple of glorious seasons where they got close, but never really close enough, and then they eventually relocated. Well, when the Carolina Hurricanes, who were the Hartford Whalers, when they won the Stanley Cup in 2006, all of a sudden everybody was loving the Whale once again. And you see Hartford Whaler paraphernalia everywhere. Go to the Hartford airport. There is Whaler gear everywhere to buy at the airport. This for a team that has not played a game in Hartford, Connecticut since April of 1997. Same thing with the Expos. Now that the Washington Nationals are a competitive team, they've been in the race the last few seasons, everybody is waiting for the Expos to be represented in the Hall of Fame again. And Tim Raines right now is the best option for them. And it stokes old memories of the Expos, and you see Expos hats and Expos unis and a lot of love for a team that hasn't played a game since September of 2004. So I can understand why there's a nice push for Tim Raines here, but again, ask yourself, are you voting for Tim Raines again in the Hall of Fame because of his career or merely because he's an Expo, and boy, it'd be nice to see an Expo hat in the Hall of Fame. I think that's going to be a big reason why he gets some of the votes that he gets. Now, again, I think he is Hall of Fame worthy. I think he's one of those bubble guys who needs a few things to work his way to get into the Hall of Fame, and I certainly wish him the best of luck. I hope he does. He was one of my favorite players to watch in the 1980s and early 90s in particular. But, you know, I'm just curious as to some of the reasoning as to why somebody may cast a vote for him. And again, if it's because, you know, he's an Expo, or you're one of these people that beats down on the steroid abusers, but you're going to give a hug to the guy who admittedly abused cocaine for several years, you're being hypocritical there, and I have to question your vote. Not that really matters because, well, I don't have a vote, but I just wanted to throw those out there. So Tim Raines, certainly wish him the best of luck in getting into the Hall of Fame. He's one of those guys that's close, not a slam dunk, needs a few things to kind of get around and line up for him. But it'll be interesting to see come January if he's able to make the cut, as well as guys like Jeff Bagwell, Yvonne Rodriguez. Does Manny Ramirez get close? We'll wait and see when that comes around again in January. All right, well, our time with the 89 Tops has come and gone. If you want to comment about the top set, if you want to talk about Tim Raines, the Expos, or anything else I've had to discuss, you're more than welcome to. Again, our Twitter feed is at Wax and Gum Stains. Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter feed, and we certainly look forward to your commentary over the next few days. And we also look forward to moving on to 1990. We'll take a look at the 1990 Upper Deck set and our random pull in our next Wax Ecstatic podcast. Coming out Friday, we're here every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic.